Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. On Monday, December 16th, 2013, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Can you believe the countdown is here? 9 more shopping days until Christmas.
It was just Thanksgiving. How did that happen?
I don't know, but we need to take time to embellish what this season is really about instead. So many of us just get tied up in the materialism and rushing around.
Right. If you love me a lot, you'll buy me an expensive present. Is that what it's about?
And eating as many cookies as you can.
Have you gained your 8 pounds yet? That's what the average American gains between Thanksgiving and New Year's.
I know. I don't even want people to give me those tempting things.
And you just lost some weight, too. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you look beautiful.
Well, thank you. But anyway, we need to remember what this season represents, and it does represent the birth of Jesus and what that means, loving and giving and not just receiving and
worrying
about.
Well, that's what Christmas is all about. That's right.
And it's for our children
and our grandchildren. That's right. Yeah. It's a time of connection.
And reaching out to people who don't have families, too.
Right.
Because it can be a very depressing time for them.
A lot of people get depressed around Christmas time. You know, they're alone, they've had families maybe that were dysfunctional, and they don't get together anymore. Or they do get together, and it's not very pleasant, and they dread it. I mean, not everybody looks forward to the holidays where families get together. Keep in mind that 25% of families have a lot of abuse, whether it's physical, emotional, or sexual. So there's a lot of stuff happening at Christmas time.
So anyway, thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include what happens to kids when their dads disappear.
And a risk factor that young women should know about breast cancer.
And what is this thing called breast tomosynthesis? It sounds like a name of a disease. But will this actually replace digital mammograms?
And how do stay-at-home moms are increasing their risk for obesity?
Oh, you're going to love this one. And are you better off with a male or female doctor?
Well, nowadays, with so much single parenting from divorces and adoptions and out-of-wedlock babies and even test tube babies and same-sex marriages, is it really important for a child to be raised by both a mom and a dad?
Boy, all the things you just mentioned show us how complicated our society has gotten. And we've got step-brothers and sisters and half-brothers and sisters and different mothers and different fathers, and families are big sometimes. There may be 8, 10 kids when you're blending 3 or 4 families together. And now the question is do you have to have 2 parents? I mean, which 2 do you want?
Well, many people think that they can do fine on their own. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is better to have 1 parent than no parent.
Oh, for sure.
But studies have been done that show the importance of a mom raising a child. But what about the dad?
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about how father absenteeism affects a child's brain.
Yeah, well, that's kind of surprising, isn't it? You wouldn't really think that that there would be physical changes in the child's brain.
No, you think mostly that it would be emotional.
Well, yeah. But
and that when a child misbehaves, you think that it's because of the...
what they learned.
Yeah, well, or because of the emotional problems
that develop from split families or any other kind of arrangement that we talked about already.
But you don't think of it as being a physical change.
Well, with epigenetics, you know, we've been talking about epigenetics, which means the effect of the environment on our genes. We're learning that DNA is not very fixed. It's the effect of the environment that turns genes on and off that determine what the genes will actually do. So we have to pay attention to every kind of thing like that. And a study was done out of McGill University Health Center in December of 2013 that studied monogamous mice. There's a good one for you. We'll make it even more complicated. Monogamous mice that raise their offspring together. Did you know that one?
Well, maybe we have some things we can learn from these mice.
Well, for sure. But
I think geese are that way too, aren't they? They stay together forever.
Oh, a lot of animals do. Even human beings occasionally do. So, I mean, it's getting bizarre is all I can say. So they did study on mice, and because they're monogamous and because they raise their children together or their offspring together, it's easy to study them. And so they compared the social behavior and the brain anatomy with those mice that did have a dad and those that didn't have a dad, because they separated them. And what they found is the mice that didn't have a father had impaired social skills, but they also had changes that were abnormal in the prefrontal cortex of their brain, which is a part of the brain that controls social and cognitive skills.
So no wonder these kids are misbehaving in school.
Well, you can explain it at least in a mouse, and I think in this controlled environment, it probably has a lot of correlations to people. And with what we know about epigenetics, as I was talking about earlier, I mean, we got the perfect example here of this shouldn't be too surprising to us. So it's interesting. What I also find interesting is they said it was stronger for female offspring than it was for the male offspring when it came to addictions, especially to amphetamines. So it's,
I wonder how did they ever figure that one out?
Well, God bless them. I mean, that's what we pay them for, is due to their research. And sometimes you may think it's a big stretch, and I do too, that when you're comparing an animal of any kind to a human being. But still, we're seeing parallels here that are really important.
Well, it also brought out that they have done studies on humans.
Oh, for sure.
And the studies on the humans came out the same as
yeah, they correlate the same way
on the mice.
And now we have SPECT scans and functional MRIs. We can actually see what part of the brain lights up as certain kinds of thinking goes on.
So it can make the children end up being more aggressive.
What it does, exactly.
And have this abnormal social interaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, there may not be as much of a difference between animals and people as we think. You know, we think we're the elite, that we're the masters of the world and that we have the most intelligence and et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people assume that animals don't even have feelings. I know a lot of people feel that they're just doing reflexive things, and they don't have emotions, they don't have a spirit. But tell that to the Native Americans, who have a great respect for it.
Or people that have their own pets.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a cat. I mean, come our wonderful cat. We feel very connected to it.
And I have a couple of horses that I feel very connected to.
Sure.
Those count for pets.
Sure. When you grew up, you had you did have a dog.
Lots of times we had dogs.
Dogs. That tell me they don't have feelings or spirits. I mean, it's sometimes I think they're the ones that have got it worked out. I mean, they don't have wars like we do.
Well, you know, I had a dog once when I lived out in the country. And then when I had to, I ended up giving it to my dad.
Mm.
And something happened where he got poisoned or got cancer or whatever
terrible.
It was. And my dad told me that he was dying and he needed me to come.
Mm.
And so when I got there and he was suffering and his tummy was all hard and everything,
yeah.
He died shortly after I left.
Wow.
My dad said that he thought that he was waiting for me.
Maybe. I mean, we know examples of that. I can remember back, we had a patient who was in the Bahamas. Remember Jerry?
Right, yeah.
And he had an advanced cancer, and he was going there for what we called immunoadjunctive therapy. And he had gone there several times when he was on his deathbed and would go get the treatment there, and he'd come back and he'd be feeling good again and doing great. But this one time he went there.
He got pneumonia.
He got a bad pneumonia while he was there, and they weren't so good at treating the pneumonia. They were good at treating his cancer. And he basically died there, but he had enough money that his wife chartered a plane and
he wasn't dead. He was dying.
Yeah, but I mean, he was out of it. But he stayed totally waiting to come to California, because I remember we met him at the hospital.
Well, she called us. Yeah, we met there in the middle of the night.
Right. And that was such a spiritual, sacred experience that we had. I just know he waited. He wanted to have his last moments with all of us there, because mm-hmm. we were so close.
But anyway, if back to being missing a parent.
Mm, yeah.
If a dad's abusive, it's better to be better off to be without him, because a dad is a role model for, you know, for their children.
Sure.
And that includes what we were talking about, the daughters, because for a son, for example, he's the role model.
Mm-hmm.
For the daughter, he's the role model for her husband.
Absolutely. Sure.
How many times do you know women that marry somebody that's just like their dad?
Oh,
I mean, I have a friend who she married and had relationships with a lot of men that were abusive to her because her father was abusive to her.
Oh, yeah, I know
and
what you're talking about.
And
sure.
I think also if parents are fighting all the time and really being bad examples, they probably are better off without them.
Probably. Well, what do you think about people who are just centered in their own worlds? It's all about I, me, my, and mine. Or people that are psychopaths, or people that are killers. Where do you think they learn all this stuff? It's not like they learned it all from their parent, because you know that if you've got several kids, they come out different. You can't figure out sometimes why one is different than the others. But the role models have a lot to do with how they develop. And a bad parent, a bad role model for a child is not what they need.
And because you see your dad acting in a inappropriate way,
sure,
doesn't mean that you're going to grow up and be and act in an inappropriate way. Mm-hmm. However, your chances for being that way are a lot higher.
Sure. You can see the same thing with the dysfunctional mother. I mean, there are women who beat up their husbands, too.
Yeah.
I know we did one of the shows on that, and somebody wrote a note back and said, well, you got it right about that part, but don't forget about mentioning that there are women who are abusive that are beating their husbands and kids, too.
I used to know somebody that told me his wife was abusive to him.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, in general, moms are nurturing. They're there because the dad is usually the one who's working, although these days, a lot of the time, both parents are working. And then what we have is the role model of the nanny or whoever is taking care of the child, having another effect on the child. It gets all very complicated.
Well, the other thing is, too, with all these divorces and, you know, different problems that can come out, I think it's really important to emphasize not to badmouth
the other parent
in front of the child.
Well, if you can
you're mad at each other, you're having a fight, you have to take a breath for a second and realize who's listening to you.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Because that's also teaching the kids to be the same way.
That's right.
And you can't do that. And then when, especially when there's divorce and parents badmouth one another to the child.
No, it doesn't work.
Or they use the child to get at the parent, the other parent.
Uh-huh.
Because the kids don't want to hear it. It hurts them. It makes them feel bad. They are going to love the other parent whether you like them or not.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, they may not like them, but there's still this thing called love.
Well, they're going to love their parent no matter what their parent
pretty
does,
much,
really.
That's true. I mean, some people have to reparent because their parents really didn't give them what they needed.
And some people really do learn from the bad examples that their parents give them.
Oh,
and then
for
they're
sure.
just the opposite. And
you see that a lot. You know, if say, one parent was an alcoholic and they were exposed to that, the tendency is not to drink at all. And it's a good thing, too, because there's a lot of genetics involved with
that. Or if they have a parent that was a bad parent, then they become a super parent because they don't want to be that way.
Oh, you see that quite a bit, too. And that's fortunate. I mean, what you went through, you don't want your kids to go through. It's really, I think, looking at the side of the father, I'm really feeling sorry for a lot of fathers, because especially feeling sorry for myself in a lot of ways. Because when I was in my first marriage and I was going through medical school and had kids, I was working incredible hours, was never there, couldn't be there. And then going through internship, it was on for 36 hours and off for 12 for months at a time. You come home and you're exhausted. You don't really have time to do the things that you'd like to do as a father, let alone things you'd like to do for yourself. So there's a lot that has to do with different circumstances.
Well, it's also like that. I can remember when it was like that for me when I was a single parent, when went through my marriage breakup,
mm-hmm.
Coming home and being so exhausted from working at the hospital all day,
just being
exhausted. And then I had children to take care of and mm-hmm. dinner to fix and house to take care mm-hmm. of and figuring out babysitting and all
sure.
that kind of thing. So
sure.
it goes both ways. The other thing is that a lot of women end up complaining about the dads because they say, well, the dads just have them on the weekends or whatever it is, mm-hmm. or the every other weekend, mm-hmm. whatever your arrangement is with your custody. And it's like he's just the great dad. You know, he's the one that has all the fun with them and takes
sure.
them to the zoo or to the park or takes them on a boat or whatever he does. And the mom is the one stuck home doing all the other stuff, you know, the
sure.
disciplining and
Sure.
And the day-to-day activity.
Well, look what happens with blended marriages, too. Now you've got another whole situation. You've got a new father or a new
like
mother
the Brady
or both.
Bunch.
Or both. And while it doesn't always work out as well as the Brady Bunch.
It doesn't work out like a Brady Bunch.
There's a lot involved.
There's guilt. There's jealousy.
Oh, yeah.
There's competition.
Yeah. So, I mean, it gets really complicated. Now, we've been married 35 years.
Yesterday was our anniversary.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. And that really is something that's an achievement after going through a first marriage where there are five kids involved, like there were for us. I had three and you had two. And I remember thinking, we should just have one more or two more of our own. And you're going, look, I got five fingers on my hand. If we needed more kids, I'd have had more fingers. Even though you didn't mean it that way, it was kind of true because, I mean, how many kids do you want?
Well, the fun part was the grandchildren.
Oh, for sure. Now, that's easy. And now I know why grandchildren are there, or grandpas and grandmas are there, because what a role they play to try and balance things out. When things don't go well for the parents, I mean, the grandparents are invaluable because they only see them, the grandkids, some of the time. But it's really quality time, and there's a kind of thing, I think we have a lot more patience than...
Well, we've learned over the years, you know. We've become a little wiser, and also we're in a different situation.
Sure.
We don't have the same kind of pressures that we did when we were younger.
Sure. And you know what kids need, and you're more inclined to see it because you're not centered and connected to it right away. So having good grandparents for a child is really a big deal. So I know I miss my grandparents, and you had a really special arrangement with your own grandmother, who had a lot to do with your turning out the way you did.
Well, that's why I'm such a good grandma.
Well, you are. You were a great mom, too, and still are. I mean, your kids still need you, even though our kids are almost older than us now. At least that's what I'm saying now. We got kids that are in their 40s. That's Yeah, right. You're right. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on... Oh, this is a good one. What's the phone? Periprotoscians, whatever the heck that is, we'll learn about in a minute. And then when we come back, we'll be talking about a risk factor young women should know about breast cancer.
Winston Churchill loved periprotoscians.
He loved what? Was that is that a dinner?
Periprotoscians, they're figures of speech in which the latter part of the sentence or phrase is surprising or unexpected.
Wow.
So I wanted to share some with our listeners because laughter is the best medicine.
Sure, it sounds more like a disease. Than it does
well,
that.
Here's one. Where there's a will, I want to be in it.
Oh, right. That's cool.
The last thing I want to do is hurt you. But it's still on my list. Since light travels faster than sound, some people appear bright until you hear them speak.
Oh, dear.
If I agreed with you, we'd both be wrong.
Oh.
We never really grow up. We only learn how to act in public.
So true.
War does not determine who is right, only who is left.
That's true.
Knowledge is knowing a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad.
Okay.
You know, they do that sometimes at the
Thai
restaurant.
That, yeah.
And I prefer to not have it in there. Well,
with mangoes and tomatoes?
I'd rather just have the mangoes.
Good mangoes as well, okay.
They begin the evening news with good evening, then proceed to tell you why it isn't.
That's so true.
To steal ideas from one person is plagiarism. To steal from many is research.
Oh, there we go.
I thought I wanted a career. Turns out I just wanted paychecks. In filling out an application where it says in case of emergency, notify, I put doctor.
That's a good one most of the time.
Yeah. Behind every successful man is his woman. Behind the fall of a successful man is usually another woman.
Oh, wow. Women have a lot of power, huh?
A clear conscience is a sign of a fuzzy memory.
Mm.
You do not need a parachute to skydive. You only need a parachute to skydive twice.
That's true.
Money can't buy happiness, but it sure makes misery easier to live with.
Mm.
And there's a fine line between cuddling and holding somebody down so they can't get away.
So why are you laughing? That's great.
I used to be indecisive. Now I'm not so sure.
Mm.
You're never too old to learn something stupid. To be sure of hitting the target, shoot first and call whatever you hit the target.
Oh, that's a good way out of it.
Now, change is inevitable, except from a vending machine.
Mm.
Going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than standing in a garage makes you a car.
Oh, that's nasty.
Well, I could say a few things like the mafia, for example.
Mm.
Anyhow, true. Where there's a will, there are relatives.
Isn't that the truth? Oh, those are great. What do you call those things again?
Paraprosdokians.
Boy, why can't we do something in simple English?
You know, over a half of all women of childbearing age have dense fibrocystic breasts,
right,
meaning that the breasts are firm,
mm-hmm,
with some non-cancerous breast lumps that can be more tender and swollen during menstruation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, dense breasts can make it difficult to distinguish a malignancy with mammograms.
For sure.
We're going to talk about dense breasts and what fibrocystic disease is and how it relates to breast cancer. So first, let's just start out with what is fibrocystic breast disease.
Right. Okay. There, usually what happens is there's an imbalance of hormones so that the formation of the growth phase of the breast during a woman's cycle, which is where estrogen is dominant, tends to cause the breast tissue to develop. But if it overdevelops because there's too much estrogen, which we generally have in our society because we're exposed to so many chemicals like the pesticides and and other kinds of plastics and things that are in the environment that stimulate and mimic estrogen, tends to cause that part to overgrow, and they form cysts. During the last half of the cycle, when progesterone is there, it's supposed to balance it out in a way that's perfect so that there's not overgrowth. So there tends to be overstimulation of estrogen that causes these cysts to form. And that's what's called fibrocystic disease.
Do you think that birth control pills could cause that?
They might fix it, actually, although I wouldn't recommend that as a way to go because birth control pills in general are not a good way to try and solve that problem or any other problem, actually, because there's so many problems with birth control pills.
So these cysts, they have fluid in them.
Yeah.
And that's different than a solid mass.
Big
but they
difference.
They could kind of feel that way, except for they move around a little bit, and the cancerous tumors usually are fixed and hardened.
That's
fixed,
true.
Yes.
It's very hard to tell them apart, and it's really hard to tell them apart on a mammogram. And so fibrocystic breasts are breasts that have more density to them. And in general, those two terms are synonymous, dense breasts and fibrocystic disease. But there are other ways to get dense breasts. Radiation therapy, for example, will make a breast very dense because there's a lot of scar tissue there. And if you have trauma to the breast, you'll have more. So there are other ways to get it, but the bulk of the time, those terms are pretty much synonymous.
Well, is fibrocystic disease a risk factor for breast cancer?
Oh, for sure, but it depends on how much you have and what type of fibrocystic development there is. Some lesions, there is a lot of growth. They're called proliferative lesions, and that's true. And they have an increased risk, but if that's all they have, maybe it's increased one or two times above what average would be. But if the cells are abnormal, then it's a whole different story. Then you may have a risk that goes up to 4 to 6 times above what would be average.
So a woman that has fibrocystic breasts or dense breasts, do they need to worry or to do anything to diagnose it in particular, or does it just go away eventually?
Well, you'd like to, if you have that problem, deal with it. And one of the good ways to do that is to measure hormone levels. And I think the most accurate way of doing that is to measure hormone levels in the saliva. And the reason that's different from hormone levels that are in the serum is that in the serum, it's bound to, the hormones are generally bound to sex hormone binding globulin, anywhere between 90 and 95% of it. The other 5 or 10% is free and the active form of the hormone. So with estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, which are the big three that we tend to look at when we look at fibrocystic disease, that's what we're talking about.
But what would you do about it?
Well, you might want to give a little bit of progesterone during the last half of the cycle to try and balance out that estrogen dominance that leads to the development of fibrocystic disease and put you at a higher risk for developing cancer. So if that balance is not quite right and you determine it when you do the salivary hormone test or whatever test you decide to do to measure it, you can give a little progesterone cream over the breast that has the problem. And very often what I'll recommend to my patients who have that is that they take between 10 and 30 milligrams of topical progesterone cream that they put over the breast to try and make that better. And usually in two or three cycles, it gets a whole lot better.
Sometimes in a health food store, you see like yam cream and things.
Well, you have to be careful because a lot of those are proprietary and you don't know what the dosage is that you're giving. Now, you can probably get away with it, and a lot of the times it's a titration anyway. But I think the best and scientific way is to measure your levels and then to do what makes sense after that, which is usually balance out with more progesterone.
So this does seem like the normal course of things would be that a woman would not have this anymore after she went through menopause.
Well, because you don't have so much estrogen at that time. Of course, the first thing you lose when you're going through menopause is progesterone. So this is a myth that it's all about estrogen deprivation. It's about both. It's about progesterone loss first, because when you don't have any more follicles forming because you don't have any more eggs that are rupturing to cause the cycles to occur, the corpus luteum, which is a ruptured follicle, during the last half of the cycle is where you get progesterone from. So when you run out of eggs, you run out of progesterone. And, of course, both of them eventually drop off to levels that are quite a bit lower. And in that setting, you see most of the fibrocystic breast changes disappear.
Okay, so does a woman need to have this diagnosed? And if so, what's the best way to do it?
Well, you'll know it pretty much because of the way your breasts feel and the fact that you have more pain in your breasts, particularly during the last half of the cycle. And so that diagnosis can be made that way.
But what about ultrasounds and MRIs and mammograms?
Well, you can do that, and all of them will give you information about that, but a lot of that information is not so good. I would say a mammogram is not a very good way to do that. I would not diagnose it that way.
Seems like to me that would increase your risk of breast cancer.
Well, it does, but you have to keep in mind that probably you have to do 9,000 digital mammograms to cause one fatal cancer. So it's not like it's the hugest risk in the world. But it's very difficult.
Unless you had the BRCA gene.
Well, yeah, then you've got really something more to worry about, and you don't know if you do or you don't. So it's one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of doing mammograms in women under the age of 50, which is where we're seeing all these changes occur most of the time of fibrocystic disease. What we should be doing, of course, is breast thermography, because the mammogram can't differentiate very well between a fibrocystic lesion and a solid tumor, which is a cancer. Now, ultrasounds can do a pretty good job of that, but why get started with a mammogram in women under the age of 50 to start with if you're not going to be able to differentiate accurately and have a lot of false positives and negatives? And, of course, that's where the breast thermogram shines and why you should start doing breast thermography in women when they're 25 years old or 20 years old, depending on what their situation is as far as risk factors are concerned.
Getting a baseline also.
Yeah, well, that's what you would want to do. And there's no risk of dying there from a breast thermogram because nothing is done to you.
I think it's good to note here that under 50 years of age is the highest risk for the density-associated aggressive breast cancers.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so it's good to do some kind of safe test, but not the mammogram, in my opinion. And keep in mind that the U.S. is the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have that recommends doing breast mammograms under the age of 50. So all the other countries start doing mammography at age 50. All right, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what is breast tomosynthesis and is it going to be replacing digital mammograms? Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Savuta here with Nurse Vicki.
Are we causing breast cancer with cancer screening in the name of prevention? There's a new screening tool now that's called breast tomosynthesis, and because a study showed that it reduced recall rates and increased cancer detection more than digital mammograms, a hospital in Pennsylvania has been using it on all of their breast cancer screening patients as a clinical trial with this new technology.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the other side of this picture that they didn't mention?
Right. That's another whole story, isn't it?
Yep. Let's start out with what tomosynthesis is and then compare that to the digital mammograms.
Right. Well, it's a step forward in the terms that you just mentioned already. But what it is it's a limited CT scan. So basically, instead of doing a full CT scan, which has a lot of radiation, this has just a few, but it allows us still to do some cuts through breast tissue using radiation to try and make a reconstruction of the breast that helps you see cancers better. And it does do that.
Well, what are the effects, though, of the radiation, and could this increase death rates?
Well, that's right. That's another problem. So we have to look at some numbers now, so you have to pay careful attention to some of these numbers. And I'm going to present them the way they did in this study. Basically, they said that there is a recall that comes from doing a mammogram, whether it's digital or not, or doing a breast tomosynthesis. And they have recalls because there are findings that are equivocal, and they're not sure. The radiologist can't tell if there's a cancer there or not. So they call the patient back in and say, you have to do more studies. And what they found is that rate dropped from 10.4%, which means 1 out of 10 people has to do that, to 8.8%, which is a 1.6% change. Not much when you look at it that way, but when you look at the percentages, it sounds like a lot. They say it's 15%. Okay, so be that. Then they talk about the cancer detection rate is increased by using breast tomosynthesis, so the test is a little more sensitive, and instead of picking up about 4.3 cases per 1,000 people who are receiving a digital mammogram, with tomosynthesis, you pick up about 1% more. So there's about 5.3 people per 1,000 that are picked up. Now, that's only a 1% change, but when you look at the statistics again, it's like a 22% increase in detection. So it's more sensitive, and you think that's good. Then you look at what they call how accurate are they. And the accuracy of a digital mammogram is about 4.1, and the accuracy of a tomosynthesis is about a 6.0. So there's a 1.9% benefit there, which they say is a 46% increase in the accuracy of the test. Now, that makes some sense, but we have to look at some other numbers here. So far, it's sounding like they're maximizing what they're finding by using percentages instead of real numbers, but still, they
seem to...
Yeah,
it sounds a lot more impressive that way.
Yeah, it sounds more impressive. Now, how many people... How many mammograms, digital mammograms, do you have to do to save one life? Somewhere between 2,500 and 5,000 to save one life. Now, 1 in 9,000 people will die from a breast cancer that will be caused by digital mammography. 2 in 9,000 will die from tomosynthesis because there's twice as much radiation that's involved. And according to the statistics of the National Cancer Institute, every 1,000 people you do a mammogram on, one will get breast cancer. So 9 new breast cancers out of 9,000 people will form from a digital mammogram, 18 will form from tomosynthesis, and of those, one will die that has digital mammography, and 2 will die who have the tomosynthesis.
And how many are saved?
And so you're saving 3 overall, okay, if you're doing a digital mammogram, and probably 6 if you're doing a tomosynthesis.
So you're giving cancer to more people than you're saving.
Yes, but look at the numbers. They're so small out of 9,000 people. It reminds me of the shark bite story. Remember that? There was a study that was done, a hypothetical study that was done on people in Iceland who got shark bites. And they figured for every 100,000 people, there would be 2 people every year that would get a shark bite. And then somebody said, well, we could go ahead and we can make anti-shark bite screen that you could wear when you go to the ocean to swim. And what they found the next year is instead of two, there was one. So now you're looking at 100%, okay,
no, benefit. They're saying 50%.
Okay. You're saving one person, though. So there's a big difference in looking at statistics and looking at real numbers. And that's what's happening when we look at mammograms. And it kind of is a sad thing because it's giving people the wrong idea about the actual value of doing these particular tests. And it's why we should be adding to our armamentarium and using another test, which doesn't kill anybody, that has been around for a long time and has recently been perfected.
Well, the radiologists just don't want to use breast thermography. They're the ones that are promoting the tomosynthesis, the mammograms,
because of what they know. They're comfortable with that. And they have a conflict of interest that they really cash in on all the time. I find it really disappointing when you talk to the radiologists who do mammography and try to even bring up the topic of breast thermography. I know one of my patients who I referred to have an ultrasound done. The radiologist took the report for the breast thermography, threw it in the trash and said, "This is garbage. You shouldn't have done this test. Who ordered this stupid test?" Of course, I got on my little horn and followed this up. And it turns out, as usual, that the person really didn't know much about breast thermography at all, but just assumed it was no good. And when
this is what bothers me. A lot of people do that. When they don't know about something, they just negate it.
Oh, right. Well, the same thing happened in Northern California, when I was interviewed by someone, I guess their name will remain nameless. I'd love to say it because this person did a terrible thing. They interviewed me and my staff about breast thermography and then published a whole bunch of information that was false and got a professor at University of California in San Francisco to say that there was no data to show that there was any benefit from breast thermography at all. And of course, I've sent back numerous emails saying we should talk about this because I'd like to present you the data, and even sent some data to that person. I've gotten no response.
Just ignored.
It's annoying because it's so unscientific and so one-sided. We should at least look at the data before we start making conclusions about what's good and what's not good.
But you see, it's a conflict of interest because the radiologists want to do radiation. They don't want to do breast thermography.
Well, they could. There'd be no reason why they couldn't adopt that. And by the way, breast thermography is FDA approved as an adjunct to mammography. It was approved in 1982. So there's nothing that says this is being used off-label or anything. And all I've always been suggesting all along is, why don't we add breast thermography to the armamentarium of the radiologist so we have a better way to screen people for breast cancer that doesn't cause breast cancer?
I think that the absence of reporting things is lying.
It is. And the failure to look into this is also deceiving not only yourself but the public. And so this wonderful technology that works does need to have improvements. I'm the first to know that. We need to have readers that know what they're doing. And I'd love it if the radiologists would take on that responsibility. Not to say that there aren't some very competent people who are reading them now. There are. But you just can't be sure.
Well, maybe they're lazy and don't want to learn something new. And yet they're out there trying to figure out more different types of radiation to
they
do it with, like the tomosynthesis.
They want to perfect what they have that doesn't work so well. And it's not like tomosynthesis couldn't have a place. It could, just like the MRI does. But you're looking at cost and you're looking at
radiation. So the tomosynthesis has fewer errors but more deaths.
Yes, that's one way to look at what the bottom line is.
And it doubles the radiation of the mammograms.
Exactly. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Zabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip-on. Did you know this amazing fact? I'm sure she'll come up with something that's very amazing. She always does. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how stay-at-home moms are increasing their risk for obesity. And then, are you better off with a male or a female physician?
So, do you have coleslaw on your shopping list?
Coleslaw?
Well, I have some facts about the cures of cabbage.
Oh, yeah.
And raw cabbage. It's one of the best vegetables that you can take to ease inflammation of the joints. Ever
really?
Since I read this, I've been eating raw cabbage all week. And to tell you the truth, I think it has made a difference.
Really?
It's also good for curing a headache. It's also an excellent home remedy for obesity. And research has shown that cabbage contains a chemical that's called tartaric acid, and that inhibits the conversion of sugar and other carbohydrates into fat. And just one cup of cabbage supplies 91% of the recommended daily amount of vitamin K and 50% of vitamin C. So if you haven't been in the habit of eating raw cabbage, you better get started.
Right.
Because the right food can be medicinal. It's not just something to satisfy our taste buds. Another thing to keep in mind is it's good to get both the colors, you know, because it's good to have vegetables that have red in them as well as the green in them.
Different pigments, yeah.
Yeah, and so you can make coleslaw, you can add it to your green drinks. And you know what I found is this really tasty sesame miso dressing.
Mm.
And I put that on the cabbage and it's delicious. The other thing that people can use is that they can add it to their steam when they have an upper respiratory infection from when they inhale it.
Interesting.
And that's supposed to really make a difference. But make sure that it's not too hot, the steam isn't too hot, because a lot of people tend to burn the sinus membranes.
So the Irish were right. Corned beef and cabbage on St. Paddy's Day.
Yeah,
huh?
but that's cooking it. So we're talking raw
cabbage. Raw cabbage.
Raw cabbage.
Cool. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So it seems that there's studies on just about everything. And here's one on how doing less housework can contribute to the obesity epidemic. Did we really need this study? I mean, we know that watching TV and being on the internet don't count for physical exercise. And I was thinking, well, so how about doing it while exercising, like on the treadmill or on a trampoline or while you're lifting your weights or stretching or whatever else you're doing? If you want to watch TV, do it while you're moving around or while you're folding your laundry, you can do it, or cooking or cleaning the kitchen. And if we have kids and a spouse, we need to be present with them anyway instead of watching TV and doing the internet all the time. Have you ever seen people go out to dinner and they're all sitting around the table and they're all doing their cell phones and clicking and everything?
Yeah, I have.
What's all this mean anyway?
Well, I think we're picking on women here a little bit. I mean, it's good to do a study of it. To boil it down to, women are doing more in the way of being lazy, which would be the kind of connotation I got from it, is really putting a trip on them that's not fair. I mean, you try and take care of a little kid and tell me that you don't have to have a little time for yourself. And they don't count the amount of work that you do when you're running around taking care of that little toddler either, do they?
I remember years ago, the wife of one of your best friends told me that just before he would come home, she'd open up all the closets and pull out the vacuums and the dust rags and everything and make it look like she'd been cleaning house all day.
Smart woman. Well, I think that may be part of the reason why a lot of women are looking for jobs, is because they want to comply with what society looks at as real success. And maybe it's, quotes, more productive to have a job than it is to be a household mom.
But how about taking your baby or your kids to the park, or taking them to the zoo, or taking
all
them
kinds
places?
Of things. It's a full-time job to raise a kid, isn't it? And,
well, yeah.
And try to have them be well-balanced and knowledgeable. I mean,
and the
it
way
takes
to
a lot
raise
of time.
Them, the way to raise them is not in front of the television.
No, for sure. Well, I mean, a lot of people use a TV set as a babysitter, right?
Well,
put the crib in front of the TV set and leave your kid there to watch all kinds of things that you don't want them to see.
But anyway, they talked about how women that were employed had twice as much activity as those that were unemployed, which kind of makes
sense.
That's
not a surprise.
Unless
you
have a sedentary job.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing that they pointed out that I thought was kind of interesting is that they cut down about enough in the way of calories so that it boiled down to 225 less calories a day because they were doing less in the way of the kinds of activities that they measured. And that comes to 1.2 pounds a month and 15 pounds a year. Not a small little factor.
That's a lot.
So
that's probably a chai latte right there.
At least, that's right. So that does mean something. But I think that this is a study that has been... is a little bit unfair.
Well, the other thing they were saying, that energy metabolism is programmed in utero and early postnatal life.
Mm-hmm.
So if your mom is sedentary, that's not a good thing for the baby anyhow.
Well, it's the same thing for the dad, believe it or not. If your father is obese, you will, at the time of conception, We did a report on this a few months ago. It showed that the chances of your becoming obese were increased because of genetic changes that occur in DNA.
Well, also it might have something to do with physical activity and what you put in your mouth.
Oh, exactly. Now, this was a study that was done in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, so it's getting some real press.
So what do you want in a doctor? Does it matter if your doctor's male or female? Well, here's a study that says it does matter. Now, because women tend to follow the guidelines more in ordering prescriptions and follow-up medical exams, and men tend to order more procedures, the researchers came to the conclusion that female doctors are more productive. But what is a productive doctor, and how does this add up?
Yeah, well, see, that's the problem. I mean, who's making the guidelines, and bad based on what?
And is it productive for the patient or profit for the hospital? Or
well, see, we're getting into this whole thing of medical records that are electronic. Oh, they sound so good, because now all the information's there. You can pull it up any place at any time. You can send it out to consultants. You can send it to hospitals if somebody's in the hospital. Really convenient. And from that point of view, it's wonderful. But how about from the point of view of what happens when somebody's looking over your shoulder and watching what you're doing and then monitoring it as they are. They're doing
Big
that
brother
now.
Brother is watching you.
Well, that's right. And when that happens, if you're doing something that they don't like, one, you'll probably not have reimbursements for that, which means that you'll have to reimburse your patient if you collected funds for that. Second, if you continue to do it, you will be fined. Third, if you continue to do it, you'll probably lose your license. And if you continue to do that, you'll probably be put in jail.
Well, this is bad news for creative doctors.
Very bad news, because it's more like one size fits all. And what we're doing is taking a package of rules and saying, this is what we think is best. But who's making up those rules? A lot of the time, it's about the people who have conflicts of interest because their insurance companies.
Well, they want you to take their medicines.
Well, the drug companies would like you to do that. And one of the parameters that they looked at in this particular study that was out of the University of Montreal in December of 2013 is that in the case of diabetics, they want to be sure that you're on three medications. They mentioned one, which was statins, and I'd guess the other two are lisinopril because it helps with prevent the kidney disease that occurs there. But research that's coming out now doesn't back that up so well. And the other drug is probably metformin, but they didn't mention it here. So, yes, there are some advantages to doing the things that are recommended, like annual eye exams and exams that are every other year eye exams and annual physical examinations. And they didn't mention some things here, like inspecting the feet to make sure that they don't have peripheral neuropathies and are having ulcers or problems with circulation. A lot of things that should be done. But what are the real things that patients want from their doctor? Is it about the technologies? They want to make sure they're getting all the prescriptions they can get? Would they like to have more time? Would like to be listened to and cared for? Those are the real things.
Yeah, and the other thing, the problem with all these guidelines, it reminds me of the laws for cancer treatment.
In California.
Yeah.
If you don't do surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation, it's a felony if you try to do something else instead of that. And that's amazing. And, of course, we passed a law back in 2004 with California Citizens for Health Freedom, working under the supervision of Frank Cooney, who did a wonderful job with about a half a dozen or a dozen of us who went to Sacramento and lobbied for a bill that made it legal for doctors to do any kind of practice they want in complementary and alternative medicine, so long as they don't dissuade their patients from doing mainstream therapies and so long as they don't hurt their patients. That's a big step forward, because most doctors who were getting into trouble if they practiced complementary and alternative strategies because the medical boards didn't understand them and categorically just threw out that they could have any value. Now that can't be done. But there is a little public health law in California that still states what we said about chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery being the only treatments that are legal in the state of California. So that needs to be dealt with aggressively
now. Well,
see,
this is my fear of what could happen with electronic medical records.
You can bet that this kind of thing will.
We could call this robot medicine.
Well, it's trying to make one size fit all. It's taking away the creativity of doctors who are on the cutting edge to do new things. It's depriving patients of certain kinds of therapies that they can't get because they're no longer legal and they have to go out of state or out of country to be able to get them, particularly
in the case
of cancer.
In other words, you have to have money.
Yeah.
Travel.
Right. And then you're not even so sure about what you're getting a lot of the time. But if it was done in the U.S. under the guidance of a medical board that had real sophisticated knowledge about complementary alternative approaches, which are really what? They're cutting-edge approaches that haven't yet had mainstream research done on them. The National Institutes of Health could do a lot here. They could start allowing that research to be funded. You know, we have a Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine at the National Institutes of Health, but their budget is far, far less than what's given for mainstream research, which is a shame because what we're talking about is, do we want to do same old, or do we want to try and look at new cutting-edge strategies and test them, even if they don't particularly make any money? And that's where the real rub comes in, because a lot of that, a lot of what's done in medicine is based on what does it cost and who's making money off of it. When you're looking at inexpensive therapies, which can be done for the treatment of cancer, especially with things like artemisinin or methyljasmate or IV vitamin C or mistletoe or all the other, I mean, the hundreds of other approaches that can be done, those are the things that we should be studying to make sure we haven't missed something that's inexpensive and works.
Yeah, but then they're not making money.
Well,
and there's
big
seems
pharma
to be
doesn't
an assumption
like
that more meds are better care. That's what they're talking about in this study.
Well,
that means that the doctors are more productive. The female doctors that they are claiming are ordering more of the medicines.
I find that kind of ironic because when I went to medical school, we had two women in our class, and they were different than a lot of the other women who were doing other things. They were a little bit more aggressive. They were more intellectual because that's what doctors were taught to be or what the professors wanted. They want intellects in medicine. And now we've got at least 50% of people in medical school are women. And we're getting that female side, that nurturing side, that listening and caring and loving
and
respecting.
Of course, just because you're a woman doesn't mean you're that way, though.
Oh, there are a lot of women out there that are just like a lot of men that are out there. And that's not to say all men are like that either, because they're not.
Well, the first time my mom ever took me to see a gynecologist, you know, because that's kind of an embarrassing exam. She made the appointment with a female doctor. Well, the female doctor was so masculine, she might as well have been a man.
Wasn't particularly kind to you?
No, she just, I don't know, she might as well have been a man.
Well, so, I don't think it matters if you're a male or a female. What matters is how you practice.
She didn't even tell me. Anyway, she wasn't very good, I don't think.
You still remember it. It was
I remember.
More than 10 years ago, huh?
Yeah, a little more.
Yeah, so I think we need to reassess this whole business of male and female. And we also need to start looking at what do we want from healthcare in this country? Do we want what we're getting now? Do we really, are we getting healthcare reform? Does the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare give us healthcare reform?
There's sure a lot of complaints about
it. Well, there's a smidgen of it because now it's going to be possible to get an exam, which is a wellness exam that wasn't possible before. But as far as the rest is concerned, it's more about insurance reform and trying to make sure that the insurance companies are doing well. I hate to say that. Anyway, we're at the end of the show, and we want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's radio show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed in video and free access to more than 2,500 audio and video files, click on Health Headlines on the drsaputo.com homepage. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.